You know, you cannot be too Jewish.
Thank you. I couldn't possibly agree more.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, Rabbi's guest is Jeff Perlman, author of Only God Can Judge Me, The Many Lives of Tupac Shakur. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. Now that Passover is well past and over, we are in the period of the counting of the Omer, the time between the beginning of Pesach and the holiday of Shavuot, the 7 weeks that extend from the second night Seder of Pesach, the great festival of freedom, all the way until the night of Shavuot, the holiday of receiving the Ten Commandments at Sinai. Each night of this period, we perform a brief ritual, counting the Omer, reminding us of the ways our ancestors brought a special grain offering to the temple in Jerusalem, connecting them especially closely with God in this period. These subsequent 7 weeks create a time for deepening the experience of freedom of Passover through the slow and steady work of self-exploration, examining habits of thought and behavior that have kept us enslaved, and which we can jettison and become more free. According to mystical tradition, each day of this 7-week period of the Omer is viewed as a time for spiritual and moral transformation. Each of the 49 days is seen as an opportunity to meditate on a specific pair of qualities through which to refine ourselves on the journey back to Sinai, to prepare, if you will, to receive revelation once again. In a way, it's an opportunity for personal awareness and moral growth during this springtime period of the year. The first week of Sfirat HaOmer, the counting of the Omer, was focused on chesed last week, on love or kindness. This week, we are supposed to focus on gvurah, usually translated as strength, but which really reflects moral restraint and consistency in our good conduct. Next week, the quality we are to pay special attention to is Tiferet, harmony and beauty. It's a lovely way to seek greater human quality in life, to reflect on how to improve your experience of those around you, how to make yourself a better person. While this way of thinking about the period of the counting of the Omer is usually called Kabbalistic, that is, Jewishly mystical, and it certainly derives its ideas from the Sfirot, the spheres of divine energy in Kabbalah, I believe it is actually much more oriented towards Musar, the Jewish practice of practical morality, individual ethics, self-improvement. Whatever its origins, the concept of focusing on internal growth during this season of natural growth can be beautiful and meaningful. So, this week, take a few minutes each evening. Reflect how you can demonstrate better self-control in a healthy way. I personally am going to try to avoid losing my patience, especially while driving my car. The setting for the blessing for the counting of the Omer that we'll play this morning includes the introduction to the blessing, as used by Sephardim and Hasidim. It reads, "For the sake of the unification of the transcendent creative power with the divine presence dwelling here and now, I am here. I am ready to fulfill the mitzvah of counting the Omer." Musical composition is by Sam Benjamin Shir Yaakov Fate. Performances by Yosef Goldman, Deborah Sachs Mintz, and Chava Mirel. With Joey Weisenberg on mandolin, Zach Fredman on guitar, Daniel Ori on bass, and Megan Wieder Gold on violin. And it's pretty.
L'shem yichud kodesh brichu ushchinteh hineni muchan u'mezuman lekayem mitzvat aseh
shem yichud kuch abrichush chintei hineni muchan umezuman lekayem mitzvat aseh shel sfirat haomer shel sfirat Shabbatot temimotiena Sheva Shabbatot temimotiena Shanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu al sfirat haomer al sfirat haomer al sfirat haomer al sfirat Shabbatot temimotiena Sheva Shabbatot temimotiena
was the blessing and meditation for the Sfirat HaOmer, the period of the counting between Passover and Shavuot. We're in the second week of the 7 weeks of counting each day, so that we may make every day count. When we come back in a moment on To Jewish, our guest this morning will be Jeff Perlman, a top sports writer and New York Times bestselling author who has ventured into a new realm away from sports. His new book is about rap legend Tupac Shakur. It's called Only God Can Judge Me, The Many Lives of Tupac Shakur. Meet Jeff Perlman when we return in a moment on To Jewish.
Congregation Beit Simcha hosts a historic celebration honoring the 100th birthday of Rabbi and cantor Baruch J. Kohan.
Hashkivenu.
Everyone is invited to join us for A Century of Blessing, Sunday, April 26th, 2026, from 2 p.m. to 4:30 p.m. at the Congregation Sanctuary, 12111 North La Cholla Boulevard. You can find out more at www.beitsimchatucson.org, a true national Jewish treasure. Rabbi Baruch Kohan's century of life is defined by an extraordinary blend of spiritual leadership and artistic achievement. His diverse career spans roles as a World War II Navy sonar man, a successful TV producer during Hollywood's golden age, a prolific composer, recording artist, concert performer, author, editor, and dedicated educator. He famously taught actor Gene Wilder how to chant like a traditional rabbi for the film The Frisco Kid.
Rabbi Baruch Kohan's life is a testament to the power of tradition, creativity, and joy, said Rabbi Sam Kohan of Beit Simcha. Come celebrate 100 years of his music, his teaching, and his spirit. His contributions nationally and right here make this incredible event an honor for our entire community. The Century of Blessing Party includes Baruch Kohan's music, his favorite foods, ice cream cake and bourbon, swing music by the Jazzmatics, classic cars from the 1920s, and much more. You can wish Baruch Kohan a happy 100th birthday in his tribute book and sign up to attend this great afternoon at www.beitsimchatucson.org or by calling 520-276-5675. Sunday, April 26th at 2 p.m. at Beit Simcha. Don't miss this historic afternoon.
We are delighted to welcome the two Jewish art guests this morning. Jeff Perlman was a longtime prominent sports writer for Sports Illustrated and many other platforms, written a number of books, really all of them about prominent sports figures. His new book, however, is about Tupac Shakur, and called The Many Lives of Tupac Shakur, Only God Can Judge Me. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Did you know that Tupac was Jewish? Is that why you're having me on here?
I'm so shocked. It's amazing.
Yeah.
You find out so many things on Two Jewish, but I do know you're Jewish. Jeff, before we get into Tupac, I think it's very important that you ask our audience a question that I heard you ask a book forum earlier, which is, was your mom right at your bar mitzvah?
My mom loves every time I bring this up, so I'm going to bring it up. Okay, it's 1985, Mount Kisco Holiday Inn. We have my bar mitzvah, and all three parts, there are three parts, the three components of the bar mitzvah. There's obviously the service, which we held in a room at the Mount Kisco Holiday Inn. Then there was a cocktail reception, and then there was the main party. And my mom invited about 40% of the guests to all three segments, but the other 60% were only invited to the cocktail hour. Now, since all three were in the same room, the people only invited to the cocktail hour were very painfully aware that they weren't invited to the main event, but they couldn't have known this before showing up. So like they got invitation, cocktail reception to follow, while others got invitation saying cocktail reception and whatever, party to follow. So I didn't realize at age 13 how egregious this was, but years later, I maintain 60% of my bar mitzvah attendees were like, what the hell is going on here? We didn't know we were on the B list. And my mom refuses to acknowledge she was wrong, but you, as a rabbi, you would agree with me, would you not?
I completely agree. It's like inviting people to come to the Seder and leave before the meal.
Correct.
It's just morally wrong. You've written about all kinds of sports figures. You have a terrific podcast, one of the most entertaining ones I've ever seen, with a guy just sitting there talking. It's great. About all of your experience, and you bring up some of the worst people and some of the best. You have a book, Showtime, that was the basis for the TV series on that great little series about the LA Lakers, one of my childhood loves. Teenage loves. All right, 20s, I'll admit it. 40s still a little bit, but tell us why you decided to write about Tupac Shakur.
I'd written 10 sports books, and I'd been a writer at Sports Illustrated for a good amount of time, and I really wanted to try something different and something out of my element. And I grew up a big hip-hop fan, listening to a lot of hip-hop, and I just thought, here's an opportunity to dig into a subject that I just am a complete outsider to. Like, part of the joys of journalism for me is the dig and going to worlds you're not that familiar with and meeting people you wouldn't normally meet. So I really love the idea, and it came to fruition. Like, I love going to Marin City, where Tupac spent part of his childhood, and sitting with the old crack dealers, and going to Baltimore and going to his row house and walking around this neighborhood and having this one woman say, she goes, what's a white boy doing in East Baltimore?
Yeah.
And I'm like, working on a Tupac book. And she's like, okay, let's talk. You know, like,
wow.
I love that stuff. Like, I love that stuff. And this kind of project just gave me a chance to do something I'd never done before.
We will talk much more with Jeff Perlman on Two Jewish, including an incredible story. You don't want to miss it, that he will tell, I'm pretty sure, when we come back in just a moment.
Nine, 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 nine.
Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a terrific array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established over 7 years ago by wonderful congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for Shabbat services or attend on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org for the schedule. We welcome members and guests. Always call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious school is available for school-age kids and grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Torah Tikes program for the youngest kids, Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah programs, confirmation, and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with terrific Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. All of our services, classes, and events are open to everybody. Come in person Friday night. Shabbat evening celebration services with full music are available at 6:30 p.m., always followed by a delicious Onig Shabbat. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m. Services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Or you can attend services on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. Or come to our Adult Education Academy classes live and on Zoom. All of them available through our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more about Beit Simcha, to come to services, Torah Tikes, Religious School, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, Confirmation, High School programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona. Welcome back, our randomly recurring Haikus for Jews. Today I am a man, tomorrow I'll return to the seventh grade. And a second haiku for Jews. Testing the warm milk on her wrist, she sighs softly, but her son is 40. Those were our mystically occurring haikus for Jews. For you, a little enlightenment. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So we talked a little bit about Nordic countries, Nordic Jewish communities last week. If we go across the Baltic, not that far, there are several major Jewish communities, important, diverse, and they still exist, even although they were by and large devastated in the Holocaust. I'm thinking particularly of Lithuania, but Latvia and Estonia also had their unique Jewish communities. Let's explore that a little.
Yeah, so all three of the Baltic countries have had important Jewish communities, but to different degrees. And even the cities are very different sizes. Estonia is the smallest of the three Baltic countries. It's the closest to Finland. They're connected by high-speed ferries or catamarans, or I think it takes 90 minutes. And Estonian is essentially a dialect of Finnish. So Finnish and Estonian are mutually comprehensible. The other two Baltic languages, Lithuanian and Latvian, are completely different. They are not mutually comprehensible, but they trace their origins to the same roots. They are called Uralic languages. Not sure why. It has probably to do with the Ural Mountains. And eventually, after years of Soviet domination, the vast majority of people in all three of the Baltic countries spoke Russian as well. They were bilingual. And I was surprised on my most recent visit to Riga, which wasn't so recent, but anyway, to learn that if you really want to get a job, you have to be fluent in Russian, even though there's a lot of national spirit and Latvian only and blah, blah, blah. To be employed as a bartender or something, you have to speak Russian. So there's still a certain amount of Russian political and cultural power in all three of those countries. Jewishly, probably the most famous was Lithuania, of which the capital is Vilnius in Lithuanian, Vilno in Polish, and Vilna in English. And
Yiddish, we might add. Yeah, you know.
Okay, we think of the Vilna Gaon. We think of Litvox as a category of Yiddish speakers.
Actually, the most famous edition of the Talmud is the Vilna Shas, which was published in the 19th century, and part of this incredible scholarship that was centered, really, in the Lithuanian Jewish community. They were considered the best Talmudists in the world for centuries.
Well, also, numerically, Vilna is much bigger than the other two capitals. And that goes back to an important thing that many of your listeners probably don't know, which is that at one point there was something called the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth.
Right.
And that was a huge country that stretched from the Baltic to the Black Sea and encompassed probably a dozen modern-day countries. And its capital was in Vilna. So Vilnius looks like a royal city. It feels like a royal city. And shouldn't surprise anyone that it was a great center of Jewish scholarship. One of the things that surprised me was, in fact, how close Lithuania and Galicia are to each other. The most famous city of Galicia is Lviv, or Lvov, which in German, and probably also in Yiddish, is Lemberg.
Lemberg, right.
And if you buy an Austrian Airlines ticket to go between Lviv and Vienna, you'll get confused because it will show Lemberg rather than Lviv.
Right.
Now, why there's a Galicia there goes way back into history when there were basically two Habsburg countries. There were the Spanish Habsburg and the Austrian Habsburg. And they had a rivalry. And a major region in northwestern Spain is called Galicia. So the Austrian Habsburg decided they wanted to have their own Galicia. So their conquest in what is today mostly Ukraine, but the area surrounding Lviv was called Galicia by the choice of the Habsburg rulers.
It's really interesting because they used to define a Jewish intermarriage as a marriage between a Litvak and a Galicianer. They pronounced the Yiddish differently. Their kinds of gefilte fish tasted different, you know.
Right.
Huge, huge differences, of course. I'm being a little...
One is Zygizunt and the other is Zygizunt.
Yeah, yeah. Boy, that's enough to go to war, I'll tell you.
Right.
These were amazing Jewish communities, and while they were devastated by the Holocaust, there are still active synagogues both places, and not to mention the Soviet repression.
Yeah.
There are Jewish communities in all of these places still today.
Absolutely.
Tom, thanks so much. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Abe brings his dog Benny to see the vet. So, what seems to be the problem, the vet asks. Well, says Abe, Benny is not only a truly Jewish dog, but he can talk. He can talk, says the vet. You're joking, right? Oh, no, I'm not joking, says Abe. Watch this. Abe points to the door and says, Benny, fetch. And the dog Benny turns around and says, why do you talk to me like that? Always, you order me around when you want something. I feel like a nudnik. You make me sleep on the floor. I know, you know, I have arthritis. You give me farcocta food loaded with salt and fat. So bad for me. Do you ever take me out for a decent walk? No. A quick out of the house, just enough time for a short pish, and immediately back in. How will I ever meet some nice girl dogs? I should roll over and play dead for real, for all you care. Vet is amazed. This is remarkable. I've never seen a talking dog before. He's fantastic. But why did you bring him to see me? What's the problem? Oy, says Abe. He has a terrible hearing problem. I said fetch, not kvetch. You see, kvetch means complain. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the double portion of Tazria Metzora from the book of Leviticus, and a wholly unappetizing set of portions it is indeed. Metzora in particular focuses on the question of leprosy, a dread disease of the ancient world. It's true, leprosy was an awful thing and had to be eliminated if at all possible, in particular by using quarantines to isolate people from it. But exploring what our ancestors believed to be an infectious disease at great length in a Shabbat service can scarcely be called a spiritually meaningful experience. The rabbis of our tradition recognized this problem long ago. They came up with an ingenious and meaningful reinterpretation. The word metzora, which means leprosy, was itself, they said, an abbreviation for the term in Hebrew, motzi shem ra, which means slander or evil speech. Their interpretation was based on evidence in the Torah itself. Moses' hand became leprous when he expressed doubt about the willingness of people to believe in his mission. Miriam was struck by leprosy when she spoke against Moses. The leper was a person who spoke badly about other people. Evil speech, the rabbi said, lashon hara, and its even darker partner, motzi shem ra, slander, were considered by the sages to be among the very worst sins of all. What needed to be eliminated from society was not just the biological illness leprosy, but these terrible infections, slander, gossip. The ways in which we employ language lead to many of the worst problems of society. Lashon hara, Maimonides taught, is not only a terrible epidemic disease, but a multiple murderer, killing three people. The one who shares the gossip, the one who hears the gossip, and of course, the one who is the subject of the gossip. According to Jewish law, even gossip with a kernel of truth within is lashon hara, and it is inherently wrong, causing intense societal damage. Some authorities, such as the great rabbi known as the Chofetz Chaim, go so far as to say that even gossiping about truth is morally heinous. There's an interesting parallel in our law code in the U.S. American jurisprudence has a legal principle called the fruit of the poison tree, which rules out the use of evidence collected improperly. That is, any discovery gathered in such a way is tainted, not legally admissible. So it is with metzora, slander, and all other forms of lashon hara, evil speech. Even when the gossip has elements of truth in it, it is derived from a fundamentally corrupt source. Our moral goal in life should be to completely eliminate from our lives and our habits, motzi shem ra, that awful tendency we have to speak ill of others. The rabbis teach that if you commit no slander, your own life can become clean of moral illness. By purifying our speech of words that are damaging to others, we can find our way clear to living better, holier lives. Our portion this week even delineates forms of metzora that affect the very houses in which we live, metzorat bayit. If a house is badly enough infected with this leprosy of the property, it may even need to be destroyed. It's along the lines of Abraham Lincoln's concept that a house divided against itself cannot stand. That is, a house infected with evil speech should be destroyed. If we wish to have not only personal lives, but organizations, synagogues, communities, nations, in which real holiness and goodness can flourish, this dreadful sin of slander must be eliminated. We can each do our part, now and always, to remove metzora, personal impurities of speech, from our own lives, our institutions, our social media, and our community. When we return in a moment on To Jewish, our guest, best-selling author Jeff Perlman, shares an amazing story of some of the discoveries he uncovered while writing his new book on Tupac Shakur. Hear those fantastic tales when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
For perhaps the first time ever, 6 in 10 Americans say they have a very or somewhat unfavorable view of Israel. That's up 20 points since 2022, according to a new Pew Research Center survey released this past week. Half of the people say they have a very unfavorable view of Israel, a proportion that has tripled over the last 4 years. This survey of 3,500 U.S. adults conducted late last month, weeks into the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran, offers the latest signal that anti-Israel sentiment is surging among Americans. Multiple previous polls show that Americans newly sympathize more often with the Palestinians than the Israelis. The poll results come as politicians on both sides of the aisle are pushing for Israel to receive less or even no U.S. aid, and as the pro-Israel lobby AIPAC has become a punching bag, especially among Democrats and progressives, of course. The latest poll replicated the partisan divide widely detected in polling. 80% of Democrats say they now have an unfavorable view of Israel, compared to 40% of Republicans. Nearly half of Democrats under age 50 say they have a very unfavorable view of Israel. While Republicans continue to hold an overall favorable view of Israel, they are split on their assessment of Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu. The Pew survey had a margin of error of about 2 percentage points. Many have little or no confidence in Netanyahu, more perhaps than have a lot or some confidence. Among Republicans under 50, only 30% of people say they have any confidence in Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. This poll is the second released recently to detect opposition to the Israeli government among Jewish Americans specifically. The Pew survey found 56% of U.S. Jews have little or no confidence in Netanyahu when it comes to world affairs. A smaller survey by the Jewish Electorate Institute found that 63% of respondents described themselves as both pro-Israel and critical of Israeli governmental policies. In other news, the 40th annual meeting of the Muslims of France will not take place due to the concerns about political terror acts targeting the community and, frankly, expressed by that community. That's according to Paris Police Chief Patrice Faure. In March, the Dutch House of Representatives adopted a motion to ban the Muslim Brotherhood from the Netherlands. Back in November of 2025, Texas Governor Greg Abbott, I think Texas is still part of the United States, but I'm not sure, also designated Muslim Brotherhood as a foreign terrorist and transnational criminal organization. Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu of Israel last week announced that his cabinet will begin ceasefire and Hezbollah disarmament talks with Lebanon as soon as possible, in light of the current active war between the IDF and Hezbollah and upcoming peace talks with Iran in Islamabad. The negotiations will focus on disarming Hezbollah and establishing peaceful relations between Israel and Lebanon, Netanyahu said. This announcement came just minutes before Hezbollah launched a barrage of rockets, triggering sirens in northern Israel.
Ari Stoudemire ties his career playoff high with a spectacular performance. 42 points, 11 rebounds.
Amari Stoudemire, the American-Israeli basketball star who became a devout convert to Judaism after he retired, is headed to the Basketball Hall of Fame. Stoudemire will be inducted into the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame class of 2026, alongside Milwaukee Bucks coach Doc Rivers, contributor Mike D'Antoni, and WNBA legends Candace Parker, Elena Delladonne, and Shamiqua Holtzclaw. 43-year-old Amari Stoudemire played 14 seasons in the NBA, first 8 with the Phoenix Suns, who retired his number 32 in 2024. Stoudemire was a 6-time All-Star, the 2003 NBA Rookie of the Year, and he won a bronze medal with the U.S. team at the 2004 Olympics. I saw Stoudemire play in Phoenix on a Suns team with Steve Nash against a Sonics team with a very young Kevin Durant. My, that was high-level hoops indeed. Stoudemire also played professionally in Israel. He won 2 Israeli Basketball Premier League championships, was named an All-Star twice, and won the league's Finals MVP in 2020. Stoudemire was inducted into the International Jewish Sports Hall of Fame last year. Mari Stoudemire formally converted to Judaism in 2020. He has been vocal about his affiliation with Black Hebrew Israelites, a movement whose core belief is that African Americans are the genealogical descendants of the ancient Israelites. He has also coached at the Maccabiya Games and owns a line of kosher wine. Stoudemire left his assistant coaching job with the Brooklyn Nets in 2022 after saying the role interfered with his Shabbat observance. Stoudemire, whose Instagram handle is Amari Israel, frequently posts on social media about studying Talmud and other Jewish texts. Amari Stoudemire joins a lineage of great Jewish basketball icons in the Hall of Fame, including Sue Bird, inducted last year, Nancy Lieberman, Nat Holman, Barney Cedran, Max Friedman, and Dolph Shays. Shays is the only other Jewish player to have his number retired in the NBA. Non-players in the Basketball Hall of Fame include coaches Red Auerbach and Harry Litwack, Harlem Globetrotters founder Abe Saperstein, coach and executive Eddie Gottlieb, the NBA's first commissioner Maurice Podoloff, and referee Dave Toby. Senda Berenson Abbott, pioneer of women's basketball, became the first woman inducted into the Hall in 1985. Mazel tov to Amari Stoudemire, and oh, by the way, three Israelis played in an NBA game last week. That's the first time that has ever happened. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Jeff Perlman, a prominent sports writer for years, the author of, is it 10 or now 11 books?
11.
11 books, 10 books on sports figures, and his newest one, Only God Can Judge Me, The Many Lives of Tupac Shakur. Jeff, digging into this story, you mentioned how you really love the thrill of the chase, like finding the story, really the grit of it. That's the journalist in you, I think. I also find it almost Talmudic because you really dig through deeply. You have this amazing story about Tupac Shakur's first hit, Brenda's Got a Baby. Could you tell that story?
Sure. So he wrote it. It was off his first album, Tupacalypse Now. And there's a song. And the song is about basically a girl who's 12 years old who gets raped by a cousin, doesn't tell anyone about her pregnancy, delivers a baby, throws a baby in the trash. And I thought it would be really interesting to actually find, based on a true story, to find the actual participants. And what happened is Tupac, way back in 1991, was filming the movie Juice in New York City, and he used to have the Daily News delivered to his trailer every day. And he's reading it one day, and there's this article, Cries in the Night, and it is about a 12-year-old girl in the Noble Drew Ali public housing in Brooklyn who was raped by a cousin, didn't tell anyone about the pregnancy, delivered the baby, threw the baby down a trash heap. Baby was found on incineration day, like before the trash compactor was supposed to go. A guy working in the basement of the building heard what he thought was a cat, and it was a baby in a plastic bag, and he picks up the baby. Well, Tupac reads this article, runs into his trailer, writes the song Brenda's Got a Baby, which begins with Brenda's got a baby, but Brenda's barely got a brain. A damn shame the girl can hardly spell her name. And I thought, wow, that's really interesting. And I work with a genealogist named Michelle Suley from my hometown of Mayo Pack, New York. And I said to her, do you think we could ever find the baby? We found the articles that Tupac read. Could we find the baby? And she's like, give me a few days. And she said, here's a number. I think this might be him. And it was a guy named Davon Hodge. And I reached out to him, and I crudely sent him a copy of the article. And I was basically like, is this you? And 2 days later, or 3 days later, we're sitting in Las Vegas. And he's telling me the story about how he was adopted when he was an infant. He didn't know much about what happened to him. His adoptive parents moved to Las Vegas. Both of his adoptive parents had recently died. He did a DNA search, and all these relatives go back to Brooklyn and the Noble Drew Ali public housing unit. And he reaches out to a bunch of them, which leads to a reunion. He goes back to the building where he was born into a plastic bag, basically. They're like, do you know about your life and your origin? He's like, not really. And they're like, well, your mom threw you down a trash heap. And then they're like, are you a fan of Tupac? And he's like, I love Tupac. And they're like, we think this song is based on you. So he has this awakening and this rediscovery of his family. And then I thought it would be cool to find the mom if we could. And my genealogist, Michelle, tracks this woman down, calls her, and says, by any chance, did you have a baby when you were 12 years old? And she's like, who is this? She's like, my name is Michelle. I'm working on a book with Jeff Perlman. And the woman starts screaming, do you know where my baby is? Do you know where my baby is? And she goes, yeah, yeah, yeah. We're with him. We have him. We know where he is. And she starts screaming and crying. She says, oh, my God, oh, my God, I need to get back home. I'm from Newark, New Jersey, but I'm away from home. And Michelle said, where are you? And she goes, well, I'm at a Red Hot Chili Peppers concert. And she said, where's the concert? And she said, Las Vegas.
Oh, my God.
And she said, that's where your son lives. And they reunited that night.
That's just, like, unbelievable. But it's true. I mean, every bit of it's true.
Yep. Correct.
In researching this book, you know, a lot of people associate hip-hop and rap with crime, misogyny, all of the stuff that came out in gangster rap early. But that really wasn't Tupac Shakur, was it?
I mean, to me, it's kind of like when people used to say about rock and roll, it's just about sex and drugs. You know, like, there's certainly songs in hip-hop and artists in hip-hop who emphasize certain elements. But Tupac, there was a lot of that in his music, no doubt about it. But Tupac was raised by a Black Panther mother, Afeni Shakur. And a lot of his goal through music was to uplift Black people, to tell people about the plight, to be a storyteller about what it's like to grow up without a father, to grow up in the projects, to grow up seeing violence outside your door. So I think he viewed himself much more as a storyteller. Now, later in his career, toward the end, I mean, he died at 25, so he was young, but when he got with Death Row Records and Suge Knight, I do feel like there were some darker impulses that took over, regrettably, in some ways. But I do think he viewed himself as a continuation of the Black Panthers more than anything.
He was kind of a theater kid growing up. I mean, there's stories in the book he carried around, what, Macbeth, was it? What was his favorite song as a kid?
Well, one of his favorites was Vincent by Don McLean.
Might be the softest pop hit ever, perhaps.
Sure.
Close.
Well, it's a great song.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, absolutely.
He went to the Baltimore School of Performing Arts. Then when he moved to Marin City, he went to the school TAM, which had a really good theater program. And if you see old videos of him, he's a very soft-spoken, delicate theater kid who used to spray paint his jeans and drink water. He would show up at the Baltimore School for the Arts with a baby bottle, and he would drink the water out of the nipple of the baby bottle. Like, he was just, his first girlfriend was the daughter of white socialist Mary Baldridge. You know, like, he was just an artsy, if you picture your local theater kid, like, that was Tupac. He was just the local theater kid.
He had a charisma that people seemed to, like, notice immediately. He was in early rap groups you talk about, and he just stood out. They wanted him. They didn't want the other guys. Talk about, like, how he was initially discovered.
Well, when he moved to Marin City, so basically he moved from Baltimore to Marin City before senior year of high school. And he's living in the projects of Marin City. It's called the Jungle where he lived. And basically there's a woman named Layla Steinberg. See, it always comes back to a Jewish person. Layla Steinberg is a...
it always
kind
does.
Of a low... I love Layla, by the way. Layla had her bar mitzvah. Layla was a local talent kind of evaluator, almost like a bird dog. And she put together shows, and Tupac was like, I want to rap for you. And she started inviting him. She held these, like, weeknight meetings, groups for local performing arts kids who came from tough backgrounds. And Tupac started showing up. And Layla connected Tupac. This is a long story short, but Layla connected Tupac with a guy named Atron Gregory, who was the manager of the hip-hop group Digital Underground. And Tupac really began his hip-hop career as kind of a roadie slash dancer for this group. They had a big hit called the Humpty Dance. And if you look at some of their old videos, Tupac is dancing with his shirt off, doing things with the blow-up doll you probably shouldn't do. Like, he was like a stage performer. They would hand out these things called sex packets. But that's how he got in. And then they started letting him rap a little. And he had a verse on a song called Same Song, and he took off from there.
His mother, as you noted, was a Black Panther. You know, that couldn't have made life easy after the heyday. Tell us a little bit about that.
So she's Afeni Shakur. As I said, there's a great book to be written about Afeni Shakur. She was a high school dropout who joined the Panthers, was basically arrested and part of this famous trial called the Panther 21 trial. This is in 1971. Turned down a court-appointed attorney to represent herself. At the time, she was pregnant with Tupac, being shuttled back and forth from jail to the courthouse every day. And she won. She shocked everyone and won. But the thing is, after the Panthers kind of fell apart, that addition to the Panthers kind of fell apart, and a lot of the guys, the Eldridge Cleavers of the world, sort of vanished or faded off. She became an addict. She struggled with financially. She had two kids. She didn't have a male role model, a father for her kids around. And it was a real drop-off. And one of the things Tupac battled with a lot was his mother was his absolute hero. She was a superstar of the Panther movement. And then to watch her become just a zombie-like crack addict really informed his music and also kind of changed who he was as a person.
He was kind of brought into the Suge Knight universe. Tell us kind of about that a little bit.
Well, so Tupac was in, he was in prison at Clinton Correctional Facility in Dannemora, New York, for sexual battery. And he'd been there for 8 months. He was waiting for someone to bail him out. Nobody came along. And Suge Knight, and I always equate Suge Knight to Don King and Donald Trump. These two guys who just smell a situation where they can take advantage and do it. And Suge Knight comes along, and he exaggerates his role in it, but he basically gets record label money to bail out Tupac. And really the conditions are, you're going to come be a part of Death Row Records. You're going to do the music we want, which is kind of gangster rap and hardcore West Coast rap. And you're going to be the star of our label. And Tupac did it. I don't think he realized the awfulness of Suge Knight. I mean, Suge Knight was a really bad guy. He's in prison right now. But he kind of fell into it. And Tupac's last album, I think, was his greatest album. His last two albums were both Death Row albums. And they're amazing, amazing albums. But Tupac found himself also just enveloped in this world of violence and sort of gang culture that wound up to his, led to his death.
He had a plan for his last album that you note in your book. He was going to mix Frank Sinatra songs with rap.
Yeah, he loved Sinatra. So when he was filming the movie Gang Related with Jim Belushi, you would walk by his trailer. In fact, the producer for the movie bought him a portable CD player and a ton of Frank Sinatra CDs, and you would just hear him sing it like Fly Me to the Moon in New York, New York. And he had this mashup plan. He wanted to do the soundtrack for the Gang Related album and make it just a mashup of Sinatra songs and Tupac, which I'm a little skeptical how that would have worked
yeah,
out.
Fascinating. You know, but he thought of it, right? I mean,
he did.
He had a talent for doing remarkable things musically.
I think he was one of the musical geniuses of our lifetimes. I truly do. He was a visionary. He was very quick with an idea, translating an idea into music. He could write like nobody's been. I found a ton of his old letters, his love letters he wrote to a girlfriend in high school. And this is when he was like 15. And the letters are just so beautifully written. He was just a different level writer and thinker. So yeah, maybe it would have worked out.
Look, I knew nothing about rap to speak of, but tiny little bits that people younger than me taught me, including future rabbis, by the way, in rabbinical school. I learned so much from your book, including the kind of great tragedy of his death. You know, I guess we tend to think about if gangster rappers get shot, it's what you should expect, but that's not how it came down.
Yeah, it's funny, because when I started researching this book, I thought, this is the dumbest death ever. And I thought, well, but maybe my perspective will change. And it's the one area where my perspective did not change. It was just stupid and unnecessary. He's basically in Las Vegas for a boxing match, Mike Tyson, Bruce Seldon, in 1996. And a bunch of the Death Row guys are there, Suge Knight. And Tupac is standing in the lobby after the fight of the MGM Grand. And he's standing next to a guy named Trayvon Lane, who's affiliated with the Bloods. And Death Row Records was a Bloods-affiliated label. And this guy, Trayvon Lane, sees someone standing a few feet away. And it's this guy, Orlando Anderson, who is affiliated with the Compton Crips. And a couple of weeks earlier, there had been a fight between the Bloods and the Crips.
Well, I mean, there was always a fight between the Bloods and the Crips, right?
Correct. I mean, you know how it
is. I grew up in L.A.
And Orlando Anderson had snatched this guy's chain. So this guy, Trayvon Lane, says to Tupac, yo, that's the guy. He's like, which guy? That guy right there. And Tupac walks up to him, says, you from the South, which is Southside Compton Crips, and punches him in the face. And all the Death Row guys beat the snot out of this guy and run off. Well, I interviewed friends of Orlando Anderson, and they all told me the same thing, which is it all sounds silly and dumb and, you know, youth is wasted on the young kind of thing. But like, if you were him and you're a Crip and you just got your butt kicked, and it's not, you didn't get your butt kicked by a gangbanger. You got your butt kicked by a rapper, and everyone saw it. And the humiliation of that could not stand. So later on that night, Orlando Anderson, his uncle, Keefe D, a couple of two other guys are driving around looking for Tupac. And there's Tupac with Suge. Tupac's hanging out the window of Suge's BMW. And Orlando Anderson's like, there he is right there. And they pull up on him and they shoot him. And he died a week later.
It's a tragic story, but it's a fascinating one. And just remarkable what he accomplished in a short time. Jeff, where can people find out more about the book, find out more about you?
JeffPerlman.com, and it's available everywhere. But I want to ask you, are you now, has this experience inspired you for your next Friday night to mash up your regular songs with some Tupac.
I at least Purim next year, I can do that. Not quite sure how it would work on Shabbat, but, you know, I'm working on it. Jeff, thanks a million. Really appreciate it. And good luck with the book, and can't wait to read your next. And by the way, guys, look up his YouTube podcast. It's terrific, too.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
Congregation Beit Simcha hosts a historic celebration honoring the 100th birthday of Rabbi and cantor Baruch J. Kohan. Everyone is invited to join us for A Century of Blessing, Sunday, April 26th, 2026, from 2 p.m. to 4:30 p.m. at the Congregation Sanctuary, 12111 North La Cholla Boulevard. You can find out more at www.beitsimchatucson.org. A true national Jewish treasure, Rabbi Baruch Kohan's century of life is defined by an extraordinary blend of spiritual leadership and artistic achievement. His diverse career spans roles as a World War II Navy sonar man, a successful TV producer during Hollywood's golden age, a prolific composer, recording artist, concert performer, author, editor, and dedicated educator. He famously taught actor Gene Wilder how to chant like a traditional rabbi for the film The Frisco Kid. Rabbi Baruch Kohan's life is a testament to the power of tradition, creativity, and joy, said Rabbi Sam Kohan of Beit Simcha. Come celebrate 100 years of his music, his teaching, and his spirit. His contributions nationally and right here make this incredible event an honor for our entire community. The Century of Blessing Party includes Baruch Kohan's music, his favorite foods, ice cream cake and bourbon, swing music by the Jazzmatics, classic cars from the 1920s, and much more. You can wish Baruch Kohan a happy 100th birthday in his tribute book and sign up to attend this great afternoon at www.beitsimchatucson.org or by calling 520-276-5675. Sunday, April 26th at 2 p.m. at Beit Simcha. Don't miss this historic afternoon.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Too Jewish. Our guest will be David Leaf, author of Smile, The Rise, Fall, and Resurrection of Brian Wilson. And please join us, Congregation Beit Simcha, every Friday night. Services in Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, 2, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading, and Kiddush, live in person and available on our Facebook page and led by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. And join us for my dad, Rabbi and cantor Baruch Kohan, a many-time guest of Too Jewish, for his 100th birthday celebration, A Century of Blessing, Sunday, April 26th at Beit Simcha. Go to beitsimchatucson.org to sign up or send the message to Rabbi Kohan. That is Baruch Kohan. That is now just 2 weeks away. Our play out this morning is a look backwards to Passover for a very fun and ridiculous mishmash of Jewish history from past two Jewish guests, Sean Altman. His quite delightful, They Tried to Kill Us, We Survived, Let's Eat. Fun and really, really silly. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt. The year was 1492. Hitler had just invaded Poland. Madonna had just become a Jew. Moses was found on the Potomac. Then he marched with Martin Luther King. He came back to free us from our bondage, 'cause S&M has never been our thing. They tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. They tried to kill us, we were faster on our feet. So they chase us to the border, there's a parting of the water. Tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. Then the Pharaoh, who looked like Yul Brynner, heard the Jews were trying to escape. Charlton Heston came right down from the mountain. He said, Pharaoh, you're a damn dirty ape. The menorah was almost out of oil. Farrakhan was planning Kristallnacht.
the gefilte was nearing extinction. It looked like Moses and his flock were forcocked. They tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. They tried to kill us, we were faster on our feet. But we knew how to resist, cause we've read in Schindler's List. Tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat.
The 10 Egyptian plagues. Blood. Locusts. Boils. Dandruff. Acne.
Too Jewish is sponsored by Too Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.
Cataracts. Sciatica. Sickle cell anemia.